advantages I have discovered through a long-term ministry. But one of the disadvantages, I think, is that at some point, I run out of stories from previous stages that I had in my life before arriving here. But I think I've got at least one that's still been on the shelf. Now, I know many of you have already heard about the part how in the mid-1970s I left the ministry with the American Baptist and spent a year trying to figure out what to do with my life. And you've heard the part about how I spent that year in Madison, Wisconsin, at the University of Wisconsin, preparing for a possible career as a social worker. Part of that preparation included taking a course and doing a practicum in family counseling and learning about family systems theory and all that sort of thing. And in the ensuing 30 years since then, I know I've forgotten far more than whatever I may have learned from that experience. What I mostly did learn was that I didn't want to be a social worker. All due respect and appreciation for those who are in that profession. But I discovered I wanted to stay in the ministry, albeit with a denomination and a faith tradition, which I felt I could serve in good faith and conscience, which is what eventually got me here. I did, however, manage to retain at least one gem of wisdom from that family counseling and practicum course that has stayed with me. I remember something that the instructor told those of us in her group very early on. She said that when a family or a couple come to see you for the first time, for just an initial meeting or an interview, they're not expecting you in that little bit of time, in that 150-minute session, to resolve all of their concerns and issues. But she went on to point out, something has to happen in that first encounter that at least gives some measure of hope that things can be different and can change for the better for that family or that couple or whoever it is you're speaking with. They have to see at least some possibility of a positive transformation for their relationship, even if they don't fully see just what such a transformation might be going, where it might be going, or what it might come to involve. They don't need to see the whole road at first, but they have to feel they're at least on a road that will get them to a better and a healthier place in their lives if you're going to see them again for a second or third, however many times it is. Well, that instructor and supervisor's name was Barbara Maloney. She was a very kind of direct, no fooling around Irish woman. She reminds me of something like that super nanny that you see on that TV show, kind of like that. I've since lost all contact with her, but that little nugget of insight she offered, that's really stayed with me during my time in the Unitarian Universalist ministry. And I keep Ms. Maloney's challenge in front of me when it comes to mine and our ministry here. What is it that has to happen when people, when seekers and searchers come into our midst for the first time that will bring them back time and again? We should seriously think on this with our Open House Sunday now 2 weeks away. And beyond that, what has to keep happening in the lives of our members and friends, like many of you, that will continue to make us a vital and nurturing and liberal religious community for all of us? For those who are just testing out the road, and for those of us who've been traveling for some time, what needs to happen in order to keep both our individual and our shared journeys moving along in a positive and healthy direction? I guess my involvement with the Kerouac exhibit over this past summer has me a little fixated on the metaphor of the road here. But I'm going to run with it for a little bit longer this morning. Like the people that Ms. Maloney referred to who were coming for counseling, I doubt that many of those who come through our doors for the first time on a Sunday service are expecting their lives to be radically transformed in the course of an hour's worship. They may not even be looking for that. They may just be curiosity seekers checking us out. And for those of us who have been on the road for a stretch, we too need to feel that we'll have our transforming moments as we move along, and I feel that the people who come here for the first time also, like those people that come for a counseling session for the first time, they need to have at least see some possibility of transformation that's going to bring them back again. So as we embark upon yet another year in our life as a congregation, we are a congregation which is much more than an aggregate of individuals. I'd like to offer some thoughts, hopefully some challenges, as the kinds of transformations we can and should be offering and experience. And to help us chart a course for the next few minutes, I'd like to give you a line from the writings of Henry Miller. You can relax, it's one of his clean ones. Most of them actually were, for the fat part. Miller wrote, "One's destination is never a place, but rather a new way of looking at things." Kind of like that. One's destination is never a place, but rather a new way of looking at things. Well, what we have here is surely a place, one that has been here for a little over 180 years now. But the destination that we offer from this place, I feel, is and can be that new way of looking at things. Maybe not first time new for many of you who've been here for many years, but new in the sense that each time we come to this destination, our perspective, our thoughts, our ways of being with one another and being in the world are renewed. Now, most traditional religious communities, such as the one in which I was raised and within which I initially entered the ministry, most of them offer a set of beliefs as a way of guiding a person's perspectives and thoughts and ways of being in the world. And I really do not disparage that. Some beliefs, of course, are healthier than others, but I think having a core set of beliefs and values is important. And sometimes I think we use kind of err in the opposite direction on that tack by playing out Mark Twain's rather playful quip when he once said, "I have my values, and if you don't like them, well, I've got some others." But this new way of looking at things that we need to be offering from our place and destination here is a way, a pathway, for determining and affirming what is, and living out what is worth believing. Indeed, one of my colleagues in the Unitarian Universalist ministry, the Reverend Davidson Laird, at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Austin, Texas, he says that the two basic faith-related questions for religious liberals today are, first of all, what is worth believing, and then second, are these deep truths ones that can sustain a spiritual quest without supernatural or otherworldly underpinnings? Those two questions. And I think to pursue these questions in both a serious and a joyful way is to engage in an ongoing act or process of transformation. And when we hold up and when we offer a religious community whose very purpose is to pursue such questions as these, then we offer some real hope for those who are on their journeys of spirit and meaning, but who may not be sure where the road they wish to take will lead them on their journey. The destination we offer them, both for ourselves and for those who come into our midst, I think should be that new way of looking at things. So I want to spend a little bit of time with those questions that Reverend Laird poses. And what I especially like is the order in which he asks them. I think that's important. He says, first, what is worth believing? Not off, right off the bat, what is intellectually or rationally defensible, but what do you find worthy of believing within your own lives? And then comes the second question, can these beliefs that I find worthy of sustaining and guiding me, are they ones that can be held apart from some otherworldly notion of the supernatural? I think he's right. Those are the two basic questions for religious liberals. And you can each and all run very well with them, I'm sure. What I want to share with you now as we launch another year in our congregational life are some of the worthy beliefs that I have come to and that have proven to be transformative for me. And I invite you to do the same. First, I believe that when it comes to the world and the universe around us, and in whose web of life our own lives are sustained, what we see is what we've got. I don't mean that we can see and know everything there is to see and know in this vast universe we inhabit. There will always be more to see, more to learn, more mysteries to pursue, more awe and more wonder to be experienced. But the transformative part, more awe and wonder to be experienced. It's just that I believe that this is the only world and universe we have. No other realms of existence are available to us. And the transformative part of this belief for me is its corollary, so to speak. What we have here is enough. I believe that's what Andrea was speaking to a little while ago. What we have here is enough. Enough to give our lives meaning and purpose and deep relatedness if we can fully open ourselves to the lives we've been given and the world we've been given to live them in. This gets me to my second belief, worthy belief or tenet. It is how we see and how we choose to see that makes the difference and is transformative for us. While the term humanist does not fully cover how I define myself, I am enough of a humanist to believe that we human beings are the meaning makers, that life's many meanings do not come to us from some otherworldly realm. We are the ones who are called to infuse with meaning the world we've been given to live in, and to seek to see it beyond its surface manifestations. My third belief is that life, without having to explain itself, both blesses and wounds us, and we're called to hold fast to it in the face of both. While the Bible is not central to my own formations of faith any longer, I continue still to be greatly taken by the Genesis myth of Jacob getting into an all-night wrestling match with an angel, or whoever it was. The story goes that Jacob is traveling at night, trying to get to a destination of his own. He encounters some kind of a being that he cannot even see. Could be a man, could be someone else, and they wrestle all night. In the course of their struggle, Jacob's hip gets wrenched out of joint. But they fight until dawn, at which point the man or the angel or God, depending upon how one reads the story, asks Jacob to let him go. Jacob replies, "I will not let you go until you bless him." Taking a cue from the late Joseph Campbell, that all mythology is really a set of stories about the many and varied aspects of the human condition, our lives are something we more or less stumble upon. We didn't pre-plan them. We just were given them. But to really take hold of our lives, however it is we got them, is to be deeply wounded at times, as well as deeply blessed. And a life credo that says to life itself, "I will not let you go unless you bless me," is, I feel, a belief worth having and living out. It is a way of keeping faith with oneself and with all of life and all of existence in the midst of both wounding adversity and great joy. Corollary here is that as part of the great chain of life, we also can be either bearers of joy, and we can wound as well. We may be thanked when we are bearers of blessings, and we have to seek forgiveness, as this Rosh Hashanah season reminds us, when we wound others or wound our earth. My fourth thing worth believing is one I'll only touch briefly upon. I believe that this world, with all of its sham and folly, with all of its human imperfections and failings, and with all of the just plain lunacy we sometimes visit upon it, and with all of its unhealed and unreconciled parts, is still worthy of our efforts, however small they may be, to make it a more humane, just, and peaceful place. We live in a world that is worthy of our efforts, however meager, to transform it in whatever ways we can. Among other things, here in this country, we contend with a war in which we were, as I still continue to read it, senselessly led, in which we now struggle to find some kind of a sensible way out. It has been over 45 years since Joseph Heller published his black humor novel, Catch 22. And I'm not sure even Mr. Heller could have foreseen a situation where we would invade a country on the basis of a terror threat which that country didn't pose and then use as a rationale for remaining there the need to fight the terrorism that our own invasion unleashed. It would almost be worth a laugh, except for the horrible human death toll of American soldiers and Iraqi civilians that have resulted from such devastating folly. As despairing as I feel at times over this matter, I do have to return to that worthy belief that this world and our lives within it are worthy of our efforts to transform. Fifth and finally for today, and perhaps as a counterpoint to what I've just said, I believe that we can never contain the beauty in which we live and move and have our being. And whether we live or whether we die, we are contained within this beauty. These words are not original with me. I first heard them spoken by the late Reverend Dean Starr. Dean was our district executive when I first came here in 1988. He served for several years after that. And Dean spoke these words shortly after he had lost his son, Paul, to the AIDS virus. 2 years after Paul Starr's death, Dean spoke to his ministerial colleagues at our annual Unitarian Universalist General Assembly, and he talked about, at that address, it was just to the ministers, one of those pre-things before the GA starts. He said he had basically given up hope of ever finding joy in his life again, and that the best he was hoping for was some relief from the pain that had been brought on by his son's death. And then he went on to tell about a short boat cruise he took one evening off the west coast of Naples, Florida. And here's how he described it. The entire sky, from horizon to horizon, was aglow with color. Reds and purples and pinks and golds. Then the colors faded, and that indescribable deep, deep indigo of late twilight filled the sky. The boat turned around, and there on the eastern horizon was a full and glorious moon. With tears streaming down my face, I realized that even though my son's being had been scattered, he remained a part of this awesome beauty. And then Dean expanded upon this experience to say this. We can never contain the beauty in which we live and move and have our beings. Whether we live or whether we die, we are contained within this beauty. Remember what I said earlier about how all we need is here in this natural world if we will but seek and find it? If, as Jesus put it, we have eyes to really see and ears to really hear. The experience that Dean describes here bears that out. And even though Dean's own being now has also been scattered like that of his son's, his words remain to bless me, and I hope all of us. To stay with these words for just another moment, I believe there is an uncontained beauty, a greater web of life, a larger chain of being. Some even call it the presence of the holy that holds us in our temporal lives here on earth. Now, catching a glimpse of that beauty and feeling that presence, as Dean did not remove the reality of the death of his son. For that had to remain with him throughout his life. But it did remind and reassure him that life with a capital L is bigger than any one of us, and that its beauty and its grace ultimately transcend the greatest of human tragedies. I find this worthy of belief. Nearly 30 years ago, I needed a new destination on my life road. And I looked forward to the academic world. The destination I found, however, was the First Unitarian Society of Madison, Wisconsin. It's a wonderful place. They have a building designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, no less, who was a member there when the building was built. And what I came to in that place, in Henry Miller's words again, was a new way of looking at things. And that proved to be transformative. And that new way of looking at things has continued to evolve over those 3 decades and has brought me to the beliefs that I have shared this morning. And I'm sure these beliefs will continue to evolve and change as my road goes on, because I'm in a place that continues to offer me new ways of looking at things. And more to the point, you're here as well. And you have that opportunity also. Still, even more to the point, we must be offering that new way of looking at things to all of those who come into our midst, to those whose life journeys have brought them to this place that means so much to so many of us. We are called to make this a place of transformation for them, just as it has been for us. I'm going to close now by adding a 6th belief that undergirds the 5 I've already shared and will give you my setup for next Sunday. It's just this. I believe that life is holy and every moment is precious. The line is from Kerouac, "On the road, you husbands slip that in somewhere." Even if I did manage to hold on until I got to the end of this. I've had quite a summer, as I've already related in our newsletter and other places. I've had quite a summer in Lowell, and I spent a fair amount of it just watching people as they were coming to the Boot Cotton Mill Museum there to view the exhibit of that original manuscript of On the Road in that 120-foot taped-together rolls of paper the way it was originally typed up by Kerouac. We were only able to display 36 feet of it at a time, given the space the Park Service had to work with, but it still made for a very impressive, even stunning exhibition. And the thing that most fascinated me, once I had sort of done my own perusals of it, the thing that most fascinated me was watching the other people who were coming in to see it. Now, this is a secular document. So secular, in fact, that it took a publisher 6 years to work up the nerve to print it. And the museum is a completely secular setting. And yet many of those who came into the exhibit, to the exhibit room, did so with the appearance of pilgrims being on some kind of a holy quest to see a sacred relic. The whole room, in fact, had the feel of being a sacred place. The exhibit's going to run another month. If you get a chance and haven't been there already, you can scoot down and see it. Those who came knew they had arrived at a special destination. It gave them a new way of looking at it. And the words, some of the words contained in that document did say, "All of life is holy, and every moment is precious." And those words actually take us beyond the usual kinds of distinctions that tend to get drawn between the sacred and the secular. Because it all really is one world. And every moment precious is a choice, a way of looking at things, a lens through which to see the world and our lives in it. It is a perspective that makes the beliefs and affirmations we have each and all come to worthy of holding. And so I'll pick up on this thread a little more next Sunday. For today, let us continue to value and appreciate this destination that continues to give us new ways of looking at things as we continue on our journey together. Let's sing together our opening hymn, our closing hymn. Number 354, "We Laugh, We Cry."